This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice were among those in attendance at a high-level conference in London today to discuss what Prime Minister Tony Blair described as the fragile enterprise of the Middle East peace process. The meeting is an attempt to take advantage of the current guarded optimism in the Middle East to revive the U.S.-backed plan known as the Roadmap. It's also a show of support for Abbas, the new president of the Palestinian Authority, who vowed today to reform Palestinian security forces, clamp down on corruption, and arrest those responsible for last week's terror attack in Tel Aviv. Despite that attack, the ceasefire declared at an Israeli-Palestinian meeting in Egypt last month continues to hold. NPR's Robert Siegel covered that meeting for All Things Considered and spent the rest of February talking with Israelis and Palestinians, students, politicians, and officials about their hopes and fears. Later in the program, Shoshana Johnson joins us to talk about her experience as a prisoner of war in Iraq 2 years ago. But first, the Middle East. If you heard Robert Siegel's reports, give us a call with any questions you might have about what he saw, who he talked to. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Robert's with us here in Studio 3A. Hope you've caught up on your sleep.
Just about, Neil.
Hopes for a settlement, hopes for peace have been crushed so often over the years in the Middle East. Is there a sense of a real possibility this time?
There's a sense of some possibility for progress. People there are they don't get all optimistic very easily about these things. Nabil Shath, who is now a deputy prime minister in the Palestinian National Authority, took on the cliche of the window of opportunity with me, and he said, we know it's not a great veranda overlooking the sea. It's a little kitchen window that's open right now. And I thought that was a reasonable image. There are some changes that have taken place. There are, I think, some real differences. And then there are some problems you can see immediately through the window of opportunity.
The two changes, one on each side, the first on the Israeli side, when Prime Minister Sharon startled, astonished so many people by proposing his plan to withdraw Jewish settlements from the Gaza Strip and some from the West Bank as well. On the Palestinian side, the renewed political opening made possible by the death of Yasser Arafat.
The two leaders are both very interesting men in very interesting situations. Ariel Sharon was a champion of Jewish settlement in the territories occupied in the Six-Day War of 1967. Then last year, for a variety of reasons, you can get many, many different theories, because all the other plans for the Middle East were not sufficient to his liking, because he had had some epiphany about the future of Israel and his role as a member of the second generation, I guess, for whatever reason, he decided to proceed with dismantling, evacuating Jewish settlements from Gaza and some from the northern West Bank. That is not, by the way, an isolated event. I was very surprised on this trip, and it struck me as something new. I hadn't been there for several years. It struck me as quite new to hear members of Sharon's Likud party, even some who were skeptical of the evacuation, of the disengagement, they call it, speaking of settlements in a new way. They want to keep the big blocks of settlements that are very close to the green line, the border, the 67 border between Israel and the West Bank. But the idea that other settlements beyond that are somehow integrally important to Israel, that their significance is great, that there's a vital historical connection to them, I'm not hearing that this time. I heard people of the right talking about how one consequence of this disengagement from Gaza, say, may very well be the delegitimation of the settlement movement. So something has changed about the relationship between at least this coalition government in Israel and the settlements, and since the settlements will at some point be a serious issue in talks between Israel and the Palestinians, that's significant. On the other side, Mahmoud Abbas, a man who was of the generation of what they used to call the Abus, Abu Ammar was Yasser Arafat, Abu Allah is the Prime Minister, Ahmed Kureya, Abu Mazen, and yet has become a champion in a way of the Palestinian Young Guard and has taken the initiative of political reform, is very much committed to a series of elections. We've had local elections, we've had a presidential election, we're going to have legislative elections, which will be quite important, and then the Fatah movement will have a kind of primary election. So he, although he is of an older Palestinian generation, is regarded as a figure of some innovation. And this despite a background with a Soviet education, a university dissertation that involved a certain element of Holocaust denial. I mean, there's, like Sharon, he's a man who's come a long way to the position that he's in right now.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the Palestinian New Guard, if you will. Mm-hmm. Let's hear. This is part of one of the conversations mm-hmm. you had. It's a clip of Ziad Abu Amr, an independent member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. He's talking about democracy in this clip, and listen carefully to this.
There is also a major discrepancy between what the people want and what governments do, especially when you have a government that is not accountable. And that's why we believe that elections, democratic, free, routine and periodic elections are extremely important, because this is a one sure way for exercising accountability and reform. And that's why I think we were excited that the election cycle has been resumed.
This is a Palestinian official. Mm-hmm. That might have been written by George W. Bush.
He might not be the most popular author, but if he were the ghostwriter, it might be acceptable. Mr. Bush is not very popular, either among Palestinians or, for that matter, in the week I spent in Egypt before, between Sharm el Sheikh and the week after. Certainly not very popular there. And yet, whether President Bush is leading or whether he's gotten in front of the parade, I'm not sure which it is, but there is a real sense you get that elections are important. It's a region that has suffered a great deal from governments that are alienated from their peoples. And Ziad Abu Amr there, I think, is expressing what several people I met in Gaza talked about, which was the sense that the government has been... At best inept, and in other respects corrupt. It has accomplished some things. They're all very proud of the election that was conducted, that resulted in the election of Mahmoud Abbas as the Palestinian Authority president. But there is a sense that things just don't work, and the only way you get ahead is if you possess a favorite saying I learned, vitamin wow, which is the letter W in Arabic, which stands for, I think it's some Arabic speaker can create, I think it's wasta, which is connections in Arabic. And there's a sense that it's a place where you don't necessarily get ahead because of your talents, but because you're plugged into one movement or the other. These reformers want to change that. I mean, they want the government to be an institution that Palestinians regard the way Israelis regard the Israeli government, something working for them, whom they elect, and they know if they don't do a good job, they'll get thrown out.
Robert Siegel, just back from almost a month in the Middle East, reporting for All Things Considered. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN@npr.org. And let's talk with Hussein. Hussein's calling from Troy, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just have a comment that I sense these democratic movements that are manifesting now, from Lebanon to Palestine. Hosni Mubarak coming up and saying, okay, we're going to, more free elections, no referendums, whatever. They seem very staged.
Staged.
Mm-hmm. Staged, mm-hmm. Yes. Even these municipal elections in Saudi Arabia, they're all being done by people who are and entities that are pro U.S., very pro U.S., that are trying to somehow artificially start a movement, artificial domino effect. Iraq, boom, 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 five other places, mm-hmm. and it's like, trying to change the essence of a people by through this theater. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, there's certainly been a facade of democracy in a lot of Arab autocracies.
I wouldn't presume to talk about what happened in Saudi Arabia. I don't know much about it, and they were only local elections. But I will say this: in in the Palestinian territories, in the local elections, Hamas, not a favorite of the United States, did very well, exceptionally well, running on mostly on the platform of being not corrupt.
I agree.
And in that sense, I think that among the Palestinians, at least, the election shapes up to be, as if as is widely expected, Hamas contests the legislative election, it's going to be a real challenge to Fatah, the dominant movement, to come up with some good, interesting candidates. That's a real election. That's a real election.
I agree. But if I can just interrupt, if you can just evince the very real fact that Mahmoud Abbas would not be worked with by the Israelis if he wasn't very tangible to their liking, if you understand what I'm saying.
Well, clearly they did not work with Yasser Arafat, who was not.
And who was elected.
Exactly. And you got to understand, before Mahmoud Abbas was put on his pedestal, a lot of the core top heads of Hamas were bam eliminated.
Yes.
You know, from a man in a wheelchair. You know, I'm speaking to the left in America. I'm sincerely speaking to the left as an Arab and as a Muslim. I'm sincerely speaking to the left and to the listeners of NPR that you please do not be naive to the workings of American foreign policy. You know, and I'm speaking to the American people here. And I'm speaking to that you know, this must not be go on, because our history is not like this. Our history really is not like this of war and killings, of borders and stuff. We never had these borders. You know, they were drawn up by outsiders, basically.
Yep.
You know, so there must be an sincere attempt to understand not our culture but our essence.
I would just, however, say to that, we're saying that in Cairo, I spoke with a number of people, young and not so young, who really wanted to not have to elect the same president for the sixth term. It meant something to them, and they felt that the government resulting from a real election might be more accountable to them.
More with Robert Siegel after a short break. Our number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Robert Siegel, who just returned from the Middle East after several weeks there filing stories for All Things Considered. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And Robert, one of the things I particularly appreciate about the stories you filed is some of the absurdities of life in Palestinian territories and Israel. Here's a clip from a report you did about some special license plates that are issued to drivers in the Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen.
And then the cars which written on Arabic the letters M and F, it is the stolen cars.
The stolen cars.
And then there is these plates which M, HF, it is a stolen cars but working at the authority.
يعني ميم فاحة يعني مسروق حكومة.
ميم فاحة it is a stolen governmental car.
سي أرقام السيارات الموجودة.
There is also another kind, but it's the same plate, but the numbers are different. The numbers which started with 25, it is a stolen cars, but it is allowed to work as taxis.
قوانين جديدة في العالم.
This is a very modern laws in the world.
You can hear your translator. He
couldn't stop laughing, Hossam. What happened was during the years of the Oslo peace process, perhaps the most sterling example of Israeli-Palestinian cooperation was in the field of car theft, and a tremendous number of cars by the thousands were stolen in Israel and then fenced in the territories into Gaza. I've seen numbers between 13 and 15,000. There, they were bought by individuals, by people who wanted to use them as taxi cabs, and also by the security officials. And of course, the Israeli owners of the cars would get, they'd claim with their insurance policies and get reimbursement, buy new cars. So the Israeli insurance companies at some point brought suit against the Palestinian Authority, since they, in effect, were footing the bill for buying cars for thousands of people in Gaza. And some part of the reimbursement plan was that people who owned those cars would pay much more for registration, and their license plates would designate that. They're hoping now to phase this out, but actually a lot of people earn a living from driving a stolen car. It gets, everyone in Gaza could see that license plate means that's a stolen car being used as a taxi cab. This is an example of how lawless things have been over the years. The same day that I was talking to that gentleman who was explaining it to us, he runs a driving school. We thought he'd be expert on such things. But there was also a traffic cop out, a team of them, stopping cars, looking for papers, and looking for approval for conversion to diesel engines, I believe it was. And I saw two cars being driven away. The drivers had to go straight away to pay a fine. And this was seen by the people around that spot as something very, very unusual, that police were actually doing their job. And I thought that, to me, one of the most interesting moments when I was there was Mahmoud Abbas, right after the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, some of the groups in Gaza were firing rockets at, I think, the Gush Katif block of Jewish settlements in Gaza. And Abbas ordered them to stop, and nothing happened. So he fired about 9 security officers. That, in Israel, was widely read as, well, it's a good sign. Abbas is making good on the pledge to give 100% effort, as they say, to show that he'll try to hold the ceasefire. Among Palestinians, it was seen positively for another reason. He was firing 9 do-nothing security officers who were seen as somewhat typical of the way things have not been run well in the past.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is John Paul. John Paul's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead, John.
I had a question for Robert Siegel.
Yes, you're on
speaking,
the air.
Yes.
I know you spoke to a lot of Palestinians and Arabs and Israelis over there in the Middle East, and I was wondering what they think about the issue of refugees who left Palestine and when they were creating Israel in 1948. What do they think about that, especially younger generation?
An issue normally encapsulated as the right of return, Robert?
I'm trying to remember if I spoke especially about it with members of the younger generation.
That's one of the main issues.
Yes. Let me put it this way. The way it's discussed there is as follows. It is, as far as Palestinians are concerned, on the record a sacred right, which cannot be compromised, and for Israelis, an absolutely impossible principle for a final agreement. On the other hand, both Israelis and Palestinians will point out that back in late 2000, after Camp David had the Camp David negotiations involving Prime Minister Barak and Yasser Arafat and President Clinton broke down and led to talks at Taba, negotiators worked out various formulae that addressed the question of refugee return, and they seem to have it down. That is, there's a solution waiting there in which there's a rather, because all polls suggest that refugees from 1948 would like to have a right acknowledged and would be very unlikely to exercise that right. There was talk of having a very limited number of people. Israel could determine the number each year who would be admitted, and that would count in the context, I believe, of a compensation package. There is, as with a lot of these very difficult issues that are looming outside the window of opportunity, negotiators, both official 4 years ago and unofficial and independent over the past 4 years, have come up with some fairly clever ways of addressing them. The problem is getting from here to there.
John Paul, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Robert, this is a curious situation where, as you were just explaining, we know what the settlement is going to look like, very close to a final agreement, whenever it is they get around to making it. Yet there is so much territory between even the point where we are now and getting to those negotiations.
There is a dispute as to what should be the next subject of negotiations. That is, should they proceed toward remain with security issues and move on to other questions? There are lots of obstacles out there, and there's a tremendous amount of mistrust. The Israelis felt that during the years of this past intifada, groups that were either in truth independent or nominally independent of the Palestinian Authority would conduct attacks against them. The Palestinian security people, some of whom they have very, very good relationships with, would go and track him down and arrest him. And then the next thing they knew, they'd be set free. Palestinians felt that the Israelis were trying to get security guarantees out of them, but they were expanding settlement activity in a way that, if not a violation of the letter of the Oslo Agreement, was a violation certainly of the spirit they saw of the Oslo Agreement. There's a tremendous amount of mistrust here, and the current ceasefire could easily founder on any one of those issues. The first test, of course, the big test, was last Friday when there was a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv, and Israelis are leaving it. They went and arrested people, mm-hmm. but they're hoping the Palestinians will follow up. There's a dispute here. The Israelis say the Palestinian National Authority should dismantle the infrastructure of terror. By that, you hear people saying they should go and arrest people. They should break up groups. They should confiscate weapons. Mahmoud Abbas and other Palestinian leaders do not describe their situation as being that strong. They want also to achieve a national Palestinian consensus, and their idea is to negotiate participation in, if not a formal ceasefire, a period of calm and quiet. Israelis are absolutely convinced that at some point there'll be a confrontation. At some point it'll be a challenge to Mr. Abbas. He will have to either go after one of these groups or another or not. The Palestinians place a lot of faith in their ability to try to gain a national political consensus.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is James. James is with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, hello, Neil, Mr. Kisiegel.
Hi, hello, James.
Yes, I was involved back in the... I'm not an Israeli or a Palestinian, but I was involved in the group called Peace Now, which supports both sides. Mm-hmm. There are both sides. There are enemies of the peace. Majority of the Israeli want peace. Majority of the Palestinians want peace. But unless the U.S. genuinely engage or involved without taking sides, there's a new... this is just a going through the motion. I don't see genuine peace, but I hope I am wrong. I really think the U.S. should make a genuine effort in this.
Robert, a piece now on the left of Israeli politics. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the changes on the right. Is the left in Israel, has the politics there changed as well?
Well, the Peace Now left is outside the government and in opposition. The Labour Party, which is a center-left party, is in the government with Sharon. And in the past, I might add, when Israel has made peace, when Menachem Begin made peace with Egypt years ago, it was not his own party, it was not this Sharon's Likud party that really supported it in parliament, it was the Labour Party that did it. This is more formal this time. There are members of the government who will tell you, one of them, Housing Minister Isaac Herzog, talked with me at some length, and I'm afraid we couldn't get the interview on the air.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that after this step of Gaza and northern West Bank withdrawal, that they can then proceed on to further evacuations and eventually probably acknowledge the strong likelihood, it'll have to be negotiated, of the territorial swaps to make up for big settlement blocks that Israel wants to keep. If they keep that, then there should be some compensation. He would say that the Likud people, the party of Ariel Sharon, they're incapable of going that far. But it sounds as if the Labour Party and other parties on the left are. I should point out here, one of the real obstacles at this moment is that in order for Israel to proceed with its withdrawal, it links that very closely to the building of the security barrier.
Speaking of obstacles. Yeah.
Right, which is a physical barrier, a physical obstacle. And in many parts, it is pretty, although the word is disputed, in many places, it sure is a wall. It looks like a big highway barrier that we'd put up to block sound from alongside an interstate. Around Gaza, there's a fence, and there has been for several years. And the Israelis link their confidence in disengagement to the presence of these barriers, which they hope will limit the possibility of people getting into Israel to commit violent acts. These barriers are anathema to the Palestinians, and they regard their presence alone as offensive, but also the route that they take as also being political and being an attempt to draw unilateral de facto boundaries. So again, another area of rather imminent argument.
James, thanks very much.
Thank
you. Let's talk now with David. David's calling from San Francisco.
Hey there. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay, I can barely hear you guys. But It just seems like a lot of what Mr. Siegel is saying is pretty much the usual kind of Israeli propaganda on this, and that fits right in with the sort of U.S. role in supporting it. That, you know, if the, you know, the Sharon is doing such a great deal of giving up Gaza, which in fact is not such a great deal because it's just too costly and too counterproductive and untenable for the Israelis. And in the meanwhile, they're taking more Palestinian land. They're using Palestinian land to build their security fence, and it's been ruled illegal by the World Court. But now they've got Abu Mazen in there, who's just sort of an amenable chump who will kind of go along with their program. And we're playing it as if that's a really, oh yeah, it's a good thing. It's a great day for peace in the world. That doesn't seem to be the way it really is.
Well, I hope, first of all, I've been a little bit more cautious than declaring it a great day for peace in the world. And I don't think Abu Mazen is just the chump who's in there. I think this is a guy who's devoted his life to the Palestinian cause, and the past 4 years of his life, like those of most Palestinians, have been pretty awful. And I think that they are trying to get back as best they can to where they were about 4 years ago. During that time, and a fellow from Hamas told me in Gaza, you know, he regards the intifada of the past few years as successful because the Israelis are leaving. You know, he feels they harassed them until they left. Whether that's true or not, or whether it's, I don't know how strong his argument is, but I think that it's there's something happening. People are moving a bit right now, and they weren't moving for 4 years. But I would be the last one to declare it, VP Day or whatever that would be.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what you're saying about the Intifada has been obviously a disaster for the Palestinians. I mean, it's like Custer the little bighorn, you know, the Indians maybe wipe out one little group of bluecoats, but then, you know, they're going to get destroyed by the big army. But I think it just seems like, you know, all of this is in the context of 50 years now almost of occupation of Palestinian lands. And now the Israelis are saying, yeah, well, we'll give, two-state solution as long as you don't have any control and as long as we can take more of your land. That just seems completely illegitimate.
I'll answer that in a moment. That's okay.
I do have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
I just want to say that one of the things that has motivated Prime Minister Sharon and other Israelis was the so-called demographic argument, which was this argument had been around for many years, which was that there are X number of people living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. When you project ahead by a few years, the majority of them, including about the 1/6 of the population of Israel, which is Arab, the majority of all those people in all those territories will be Palestinian. And the Israelis have been facing a choice ahead of them, which is, in order to remain a democratic and a Jewish state, then a Jewish majority has to be something natural and inevitable about it. Mm. If it holds on to all this land, it faces a choice. It can either become a democratic state, just happens to have about 50% Jews, or it can be a Jewish state that maintains its rule over the minority by depriving them of political rights. For some reason that I can't fully understand, since I remember this argument being read out to me by a Palestinian about 21 years ago, the penny dropped sometime in the past few years, and the Israelis at least want to see a Palestinian state that includes Gaza, and I think that nowadays they're resigned to it, including a great deal of the West Bank. President Bush, in this regard, has been pretty forthright about saying not only there should be a Palestinian state, but in Brussels the other day, he said it shouldn't just be a bunch of patchwork spots, meaning it shouldn't be the criticism you hear sometimes is cantonized into little globs on the West Bank that you can barely get from one to the other. So the U.S. is pushing as well for something that could be a viable Palestinian state?
We just have a few seconds left with you, Robert.
Oh, good.
I know you've got another job to do today. I did want to ask, there was a sense of as much weariness as optimism.
The past few years, there's no real victor over the past few years. I've heard that, many times I've heard this cliche that the war will burn itself out somewhere in various places. People will exhaust themselves from it. This, I think, may be one of those instances. People really are pretty exhausted by this. And therefore, there seem to be a number of people on both sides of the conflict who, for whatever reason, are saying, let's see if we could try getting back to something else.
Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered, just back from a month in the Middle East where he filed stories. Mr. Siegel was with us here in Studio 3A in Washington, and important to schedule these meetings before the start of baseball season.
You
Shoshana
bet. Thanks,
Johnson after a break.